listening to the Franchise Podcast Network, presented by Lucky Star Casino. KRXO FM and KRXO HD Oklahoma City, a product of Tyler Media, reaching over 1 million Oklahomans every week. Now, the Outdoor Hour, giving you the inside scoop on the great outdoors on 107.7 The Franchise.
As long as I can remember, I've been drawn to the outdoors. There's something primal in each of us that awakens when we step outside the bounds of modern society and back into the vast possibilities of the natural world. The more civilized our lives become, the louder our hearts cry for reconnection with our native ways. Failure is imminent, dangers drawing nigh, but approached with reverence and tact, the outdoors return wisdom and gain. In both the outdoors and in life, harvests are fleeting, but lessons and memories abound. With that in mind, we step forth boldly together in pursuit of ourselves outdoors. We are nothing more than tree stand troubadours. Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. Glad to have you with us this week. Man, we have talked throughout the, you know, going on now 5 years that we've been doing this show. There's a handful of episodes with a handful of guests that we're excited to have on the show. And I'm just going to come right out and say this week is one of those for me. Very, very excited about this.
Yeah, I think it's because you didn't think I was going to be here.
I was fully prepared that you may not be here this week, yes.
You're welcome.
Yeah, whenever I saw him in the conference room, I was like, oh, I didn't think you were going to be here. What's up, bro?
I mean, he was here last week, so it's easy to just kind of assume he wouldn't be.
We're creatures of habit. Once we recognize a pattern, we fall into that pattern.
Yeah. Well, this is the Outdoor Hour. I say we go ahead and jump into it. What do you think?
Let's rock and roll.
Calm down.
I am Taylor Maples.
I asked him if he did it, and he said,
I just shot a bear.
I asked him again, and again he said,
I just shot a bear.
I did it!
Still true.
Yeah, I don't know why it would
change.
The
history books still say.
Somebody came into my office, the guy that leads our billboard division of Tyler Media was in the building last week, walked in and said, whoa, that's new, and pointed at the bear rug.
And I was like, you're like, actually not.
No, it's not. It's been up here for over a year. So
Yeah. Thanks for coming and visiting me.
100%.
Yeah.
So anyways, the gentleman across the way, Joshua Wildman Stratton.
Oh, yeah.
Had to build in some suspense. Man. Short and sweet, but I like it.
Yeah.
That was new.
No, that one's old, but it's old. Really, really old. I don't play it too often.
I was going to say, I don't remember that one at all.
Well, now that I've had to transport all of our stuff into a new operating system, I rediscovered some gems. So
I totally forgot we were even dealing with that. Thank you
He's
for your service.
He's a one-trick pony, but me, I'm like a Swiss Army knife.
Yep.
That's something. Yeah. The Lord of the Boards behind the glass, the one and only Matty Goldfish.
And now, the moment you've all been waiting for.
And we've got a great guest on the phone line this week, calling in from Arkansas. And I say this with the most sincerity and adoration. Probably, objectively, the most interesting human being that I have the pleasure of calling a friend. And that is even in this room with all of you.
Wow.
Yeah. No. Just
he just disrespected the crap out of us.
The life story, the skill set, the things that this guy has done and seen and knows. I am so excited to welcome in a good buddy of mine. Dustin Doss is joining us inside the Outdoor Hour this week. Dustin, thanks for being here, brother.
Hello. Thank you, guys.
I'm not joking when I say that. I think you are arguably the most interesting human being I know. I've spent a lot of time in boats with fishing guides and a lot of time in the outdoors with people. And there are a lot of different ways that you could typecast people in certain roles. And they would all be falling short of, I think, who you are and what you do. The number of times that you and I have spent hours in a drift boat talking about chess games or authors and artists and historians, and you truly might be the most well-rounded, interesting person I know. So I truly am glad you're here.
Well, thank you for the compliment. But, you
You're welcome. Let's talk fishing a little bit.
Absolutely.
You and I met each other for the first time on the White River in Arkansas, and that trip kind of kicked off a new addiction for me. It re-energized me in the fly fishing world, and helped me really fall in love with an area that I think is one of the best hidden secrets, and it's not so secret anymore. But it is a place that you call home and a place that you get to work. What is it about the White River in that area that you find so special that called you to want to be and work there as a fishing guide?
Well, I mean, within our first 15 minutes on the boat, you landed a 27-inch brown trout and then backed that up 30 seconds later with a 20-inch brown trout. So, I mean, big brown trout, right? I mean, it's kind of what makes fishing guides tick.
Yeah.
Especially in the freshwater world. There's not a better place really in the United States that grows nocturnal feeding brown trout like the white does. It's just it has its own character, and we get to drive jet boats around. We're not back in the Colorado days where we're just running drift boats and rafts. I mean, we're mobile, and we get to go hunt big fish.
You mentioned Colorado. For our listeners, maybe we should quickly run through some of your resume, just where you've been, where you've worked, some of your experience, so that you can build maybe a little street cred with the fishing stuff. But, I mean, I know you've taught college classes. You've done a lot of different stuff. You're from Tulsa originally. Can you give us, you know, a little bit of your story, how you got to where you are?
Tulsa to D.C. for college, Colorado, 16 years in Summit County. And fishing up there, skiing up there, hunting up there, you know, living the outdoorsman's dream. And then, decided in 21 that my wife and I wanted to go to Arkansas to guide. And now we're doing, you know, half of our year in Arkansas and the other half, guiding in Florida.
I'm glad you said that, because that's another role you have played in my life. Both of you, between Dustin and Josh, my blossoming addiction to saltwater fly fishing, I have you guys to thank for as well. So,
well, you're welcome. You know, your bank account doesn't thank you. But.
No, but I do have to tell this story, because I think you may be the only fishing guide in the world that would do this. You got to a point where you said, "Hey, man, you're coming out here so regularly, I think you should just buy my drift boat. I think that would be a better investment for you."
It was, wasn't it?
It was, man. Best money I've ever spent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great lawn ornament.
It is a great lawn ornament.
Yeah, and kids' playground.
Yeah, but my kids love it.
That's right.
Man, Dustin, I want you to tell this story if you would. The first time we had my 15-month-old daughter on the boat. Will you talk about that day from your perspective?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think I've ever actually had a 15-month-old in my boat. So that was cool. Actually, Sam fished really well that day. Everyone fished well that day. It wasn't the best brown trout hunting day, but I remember we caught a bunch of rainbows. And I have the picture somewhere of your daughter passed out with you holding a rainbow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun.
In her little baby backpack. That was memorable.
I told you she was a chill baby.
Yeah, she was. I mean, you weren't lying. She slept the entire time.
That was a fun day. That was Sam's, I think, first trout on a fly rod was out of your boat.
I don't know. I can't remember if that was the case, but you might be right.
I think that was.
It was definitely her first fly fishing trip.
Yeah.
In terms of a guided trip.
Yep, guided trip. She'd been with me a few times, but I don't think I put her on any fish, so I think that was...
Not surprised there. Not surprised there.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, that's when I get the phone call.
There's no judgment either.
No judgment.
No judgment here.
No judgment. I have joked for years that God called me to be a fisher of men, not a fisher of fish, because I'd probably want to do nothing else with my life if that was the case. So I get to hang out with fishy guys like both of you. All right, what is the status of the White River? I know there's been a lot in the news lately about what's going on over in that part of the world.
Well, there are, you know, the last spring, the Spring River Hatchery was affected by a flood and washed away. And then the North Fork River Hatchery failed at the end of the summer. due to oxygen issues and water quality issues. As of now, February 1st, we did get our updated regulations, which is huge on Arkansas Game and Fish. Instead of being able to keep 5 fish, we will now have a limit of 2 rainbow trout under 14 inches, and all other species must be released immediately from Bull Shoals Dam, 40 miles downriver, to Norfolk confluence. That also extends to the Norfolk River, and below there you can keep 2 fish, either 2 rainbows under 14 or 1 rainbow under 14 and 1 over 14 being a rainbow or a brook trout, and all brown trout and tiger trout must be 24 inches or over to keep. So that is huge for our being able to grow big brown trout and relieving some pressure on these fish.
What are the opinions, and I'm not going to ask you to pick a side, but what are the opinions out there right now about what has happened and what's being done in response?
Well, every summer we know that we have oxygen issues. Last year was kind of a culminating effect. Again, we had historic flooding all through the spring, which put a lot of bio loading in the lake and caused bad water quality later in the summer as the lake heated up and tried to turn over. So, you know, Arkansas Game and Fish and the Corps of Engineers have been trying to kind of solve some of these issues for the last couple of years. Last year, they did tell us that they're going to put oxygenators on both dams. It's about a 10-year project, as each generator will get an oxygenating unit, 2 being on Norfolk and 8 being on the White. So it is a 10-year project. It's supposed to kick off this year. They're going to start on Norfolk and then move over to the White. So, you know, on the note of trying to prevent this from happening again, they are definitely on top of it. So I think everyone's kind of, you know, everyone that I've talked to is on the same page, and we're all excited for the new regulations, as well as we're excited that Arkansas Game and Fish and the Corps have reached an agreement in order to help our fishery down the line and our hatchery.
What is a reasonable timeline for the fisheries to get back to where they were before this flooding happened?
You know, we have fry. I think they got fry going at the beginning of the new year. So it'll be about 16 months until we really start our heavy stocking again to get our rainbow numbers back up. Now, what we will see is in that time with our limited catch, we should see, you know, rainbows growing larger as we are not harvesting as many. You know, during that period from October 16th is when the emergency regulations went into effect, where there was catch and release totally on the river. We saw that those rainbows were already growing quite rapidly, and by December they were gaining a lot of weight. So they were actually looking really healthy, and some of the healthier rainbows I've seen in the river in a long time. So it'll probably be another year and a half before we start seeing really the state catching back up to their stocking, their previous stocking, you know, numbers.
How is it affecting? Yeah, how is it affecting, like, you know, the economy and the revenue and all of that of the area? I know there's a ton of resorts and fly shops and people who depend on that fishery for their livelihoods.
You know, I think, and you know, I'm not sure how it's affecting a lot of the resorts. You know, being into the fly fishing world, it really did not affect us that much because we're catch and release. And we've always practiced catch and release mostly as our kind of community of fly fishing guides. So it hasn't really affected us. You know, it seems like everything's kind of been about the same. You know, kind of slowed down for the winter, and we're just kind of starting to see our spring pickup here.
Nice. I need to get back out there. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, the river's actually, like I said, the river's in pretty good shape. I mean, we're in minimum flow still, so we're definitely having bouts of low water days. But, we'll get some rain here as the spring kind of rolls around, and hopefully, you know, not like last year, but, you know, get the lake filled, and we'll have some good caddis coming up in April and May and So it's shaping up to be a good year.
Will you explain for our listeners the minimum flow and how they're running units and just kind of the nature of fishing the White River, the things you need to pay attention to?
So the White River is a hydroelectric dam. It has 8 units on it. 4 of those units are 40 megawatts an hour, and 4 of them are 50 megawatts an hour. How the Corps of Engineers has it set up is they have an elevation of what we call the pool, the top of the flood pool and the bottom of the power pool, or the power pool, rather. If the water is above the top of the power pool, so 60 feet or 659 feet, wherever they say they want it to be, at that point, the Corps of Engineers is considering it a flood runoff, and they will run water as much as they safely can. The power company has no call on it. Now, they will generate its free water for the power company in all reality. Once it is below the pool, the power company technically has the control. They still have to ask the Corps for permission to run water, but the Corps usually will say yes unless there's something catastrophic happening and they say no. But generally, the power company will then sell power or the water based on demand. So when we are below pool, if there's not a high demand for power to be sold out of the lake, then they will not run it. And that is when we get minimum flow days, which is 650 CFS. Or 750 CFS with a maximum generation of 27,000 or 26,005, something like that. We have a huge swing. But it's good. We still have very gravid fish. A lot of fish still on spawning beds, and so minimum flow is good for them. And, we will get water.
Yeah. And it's interesting, as someone that's fallen in love with the fishery and spent dozens and dozens of days and nights there over the last few years, the fishery has such a different personality and so many different nuances depending on what the flow is doing. And if it's rising, if it's falling, fish are going to go to different places and respond differently. And it really makes it a fun challenge to learn that body of water, because every minute of every day is different, and you almost have to refer back to, okay, I was here a few months ago and they were doing similar with the water. Is it going to fish the same? Is it going to fish different than that? It makes that, in my experience, a very unique challenge of a fishery.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a different river every hour. You nailed it on the head there. I mean, it is not for the faint of heart. It is, when I was guiding out west, the upper Colorado, you kind of have the peak runoff of snowmelt. You're not really fishing. The rivers are blown out. And once you start fishing, it's just a steady decline. Very rarely, unless, do you see a big pickup in water. And therefore, every 2 weeks you're cutting 2 inches off your fly, off your leader build, and you go on your way and you just shorten. Versus the White, you might see during the summer, it's not uncommon to see, 750 CFS in the morning, and by 3 o'clock, it's at 23,000.
Yeah.
And the next morning you do the same thing. So, you're talking 8 feet of water in a day and a swing that'll take 3 hours to hit you, depending on where you're fishing on the river. It could be, you're a lot of the times we're running into the upcoming water, especially during the sulfur hatch. As those fish push to the banks, they're starting to look for those sulfur hatches that are occurring, and they're eating dry flies in the afternoon.
And as someone that likes to,
it was dry that morning.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I was just going to. Is I like to stay, around the state park, Copper Johns, in that area, that stretch of the river, and you can wake up in the morning, and by lunchtime, it looks like you're in a completely different environment based on how much water they're running and how high it has gotten, and it's amazing how rapidly it can change.
Oh, yeah, it's insane to me still. It falls out the same, too, you'll be out there, and it's a big, big river. It happened to me and my friend the other day. We were just fun fishing. It was 14,000-15,000 CFS, and it started coming down, and the next thing it was 900.
Yeah, yeah. And that obviously affects the fish behavior tremendously.
Oh, for absolutely. I mean, I personally like rising water more than falling water 99.9% of days.
And why do you say that?
Well, because, you know, when we talk about, well, I mean, there's a handful of things. First of all, consistency is key on any of these, you know, southern tailwaters. Those real big fish, they, in my opinion, you know, they can find so much structure. I mean, a rock that covers their shoulders will send an eddy large enough for them to cover themselves, and they can sit in 15,000 CFS, no problem. You know, but when we get these really consistent big swings, like say in the summer during sulfur hatch, you know, those fish are having to move back into the middle of the river once the water cuts. And when it comes up and as that water is rising, they will move to the edge to go eat. And then in the afternoons, they're hunting right along the banks for sulfurs. You know, and then that water gets cut off at set, say 8, 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, that water comes down again. They have to go back into the middle of the river. So, you know, these fish are used to the almost the tidal structure of the rise and fall of the river, but they've been stuck before. So, you know, these fish, they have probably gotten stuck in their life before. So when they cut water off, those fish tend to be scrambling back towards the middle of the river. I also think it changes the pressure on their swim bladders. So I just think, you know, there's kind of a couple hours where those fish are re-getting situated back into feeding lines in that lower water. And I think it happens on the pickup too, but I think that when you get the rising water, it kicks debris up. It's almost the natural effect of our dam San Juan shuffling the river, which can give the fish a little bit more choices of meals and can kind of stimulate that feeding process for them.
Yeah. Awesome. Hey, we got to squeeze in a break. We are chatting this week with Dustin Doss about some fly fishing stuff. When we come back, we're going to talk, Josh, I know you wanted to talk, was it a little bit about the film tour? You want to talk a little bit about some trips that Dustin has going, coming up to Nepal and India. We'll get into some of that and some other stuff ahead. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, we'll do that on the other side. This is the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
You're listening to The Outdoor Hour with your host Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside The Outdoor Hour. Taylor Maples, Joshua Wildman Stratton, Maddie Goldfish, and my good friend Dustin Doss on the phone line this week. If you're interested in chatting with him more specifically about, you know, a fishing trip or learning more about Arkansas, the White River, be sure you check out Wandering Fly Outfitters. You can find him on Instagram, but just a wealth of information. And I do need to compliment you and the guys that are in your peer group out there. Brennan, for instance. I'm never without the equipment I need and the immediate knowledge from having friends like you guys. I have never passed one or the other of you on a boat on the river and not had you pull over and hand me flies or have a little bit of wisdom. And in a community of outdoorsmen where we like to say that the more the merrier, all are welcome, I think it's always cool to see people that actually put the practice into effect and are hospitable in that way. So big kudos to you guys for the way you carry yourselves on the river, and I'm grateful to be a part of that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really do believe more the merrier. And so, you know, as much as we can.
Yeah. You know, I have mixed feelings, truthfully, because I know we need advocates for what we do. But I do love, this has been big in the golf world. I don't know if you guys follow golf content much, but there's like a growing sentiment, and it's shrink the game. And part of me subscribes to that. Like, yes, I know we need more advocacy. Yes, I know we need people to be okay with a certain lifestyle in the outdoors, but I'm tired of having to share the river with people, frankly.
I know. I mean, you know, there's always those best kept secrets. I mean, my favorite one was when I was a kid fishing the Williams Fork with my family in Colorado, tailwater to the upper Colorado River. And, you know, when I moved to Colorado, I mean, there was a handful of old guys that were down there. It was quiet. You know, it was just an easy river to go fish, and you might see 2-3 people. And then Inflight Fisherman magazine wrote an article, something to the tune of Colorado's best kept secret. Well, you know how that goes. Thank you for letting that one out of the bag. And, you know, by the time I left there, I mean, you can, you know, there's two accesses there, but you couldn't park. The parking lot would just be jam packed full of people, and you're talking a river that's, you know, 3.5-4 miles of walkable water. And you have 20 cars in the parking lot, and you're just kind of like, well, that's not a secret anymore. You know, and we always talk about it with fishing pressure, right, Taylor? I mean, we've talked a lot about that, of how pressure affects our fishers. And we need the advocacy. We need the people in the industry. You know, fly fishing has had a lot of years of decline in the 90s. You know, fly fishing was a declining sport until A River Runs Through It came out. And then there's a, you know, 3,000% boom in fly fishing within that year that brought us back from the brink. And, you know, in the mid-2000s, it was kind of in a decline. And then as, you know, Instagram, I think, really kind of got a hold of it, and social media. And we saw kind of another boom, especially through COVID days. And, you know, these trends happen. But I think there's still ways that you can go, you know, find water that people aren't fishing. Taylor, we've talked about carp fishing, for example. I mean, I guarantee you there's not many people carp fishing on the fly in Oklahoma City.
Do you know, Josh, Adams at Gubbity recently did Carpageddon.
Yep.
Carp tournament, but it's what do you think about carp fishing?
I mean, it goes in flow. I think it ebbs and flows. There's been seasons of my life in Oklahoma where carp fishing, there was lots of people doing it. There's been seasons where not a lot of people are doing it. I think it will always be somewhat of a niche. But I want to go back to this idea of finding a fishery or finding a piece of river or style of fishing where there's not a lot of people. And I've been hung up on why do we care a lot lately in the last number of years. The spirit of caring if there's another human being who's like-minded, who you know, potentially God put in my life in that moment or that day to learn from, to enjoy the river with, to create memories, to learn from, to teach. Why have we culturally decided this is a bad thing? When we think back on the history of Americans hunting and fishing, outside of the time period when the population of this country was smaller than the amount of land that existed, we like to romanticize this idea that there was this time and place where you could just go and you know, do as you saw fit. And in some aspects, that's true. But in a lot of aspects, it's actually not true, because high water mark and free access to land and in the big history of America, access to public land and water is still relatively in its infancy. And so I think we're in a season that the country's been in before. Yes, obviously we have a lot more people, and you could argue that there's less opportunity for access maybe than there's ever been in the history of this country. But I've really had a really big struggle accepting this argument that a place is better just because there aren't people there.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
And the reality is, if we have to stop perpetuating that narrative, because that narrative eliminates the opportunity for education. It eliminates the opportunity for community. It eliminates the opportunity to help build the next fisherman or fishing woman that understands how to care for the fishery that they're currently on. And that can be said about public land hunting in other states or any of it. We get in this mindset, I think, where, well, no, this is my time. This is my time to reset, and you're a distraction and a complication to what I envisioned my day was going to be, opposed to walking out in God's creation and saying, God, just bring me what I need to have today. And that can be an encounter with another human being. We never know what that encounter is going to bring us. And as a whole, I've really struggled with our industry's obsession with this idea of, one, the quality of fishery being dictated by the amount of people that are on it or the value of that fishery, and two, that there's something wrong with standing shoulder to shoulder with another like-minded human being and collectively bringing it, sharing in God's glory.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think as a guide, you know, I can't wish that. How to say this nicely? I can never get behind the other guides' thoughts that, you know, fly fishing got too big.
The model train industry generates more revenue in the United States than fly fishing. I'm going to say that again. The model train industry generates more revenue than the fly fishing industry. So the idea that anyone suggests that the fly fishing industry has got too big is ignorant to the conversation that they've walked into.
I agree. Well, and the other thing is you know, that's how we keep rods on the table. That's how we keep the companies open. That's how we keep guides in business. That's how we keep boats in production. I mean, all down the line, it's how we keep flies being created by guides that are fishing certain waters that are finding an effective pattern for, you know, of their locality. I mean, we have to have new anglers. And I agree. I mean, as a guide, we are stewards. We are to teach ethics. We are to teach, you know, etiquette. We are to teach, you know, future and we are to teach our future anglers as well as teaching clients how we preserve our fisheries. Catch and release, you know, habits. I mean, that's a huge one. A lot of people I get, they don't, you know, they've never really, especially if they're new to fly fishing, they, you know, they try to gill a trout and you're like, oh, don't gill it. Here's how we hold them. I mean, that is just, you know, such good knowledge to give someone. And you know, it's kind of bittersweet though, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of a shame. And I don't see it as much in Arkansas. I see it really kind of affected Colorado, states like Colorado more. Short, small tailwaters that just got shoulder to shoulder. And, I mean, you just saw a lot of beat-up fish, especially, like, on the Dreamstream.
I think that all three of us here, we've all lived in Colorado. Josh, you've said you wouldn't go back for very similar reasons that I wouldn't go back, and I'm sure Dustin would say he wouldn't go back to this. It is not what it once was. It is not what it was when we, you know, I don't feel like I lived through the glory days of fly fishing the Dream Stream. I'm sure you guys were there before me. You probably wouldn't say it was the glory days, but I think if we were there today, we would look back on 10, 12 years ago and say, man, I wish it still were what it was. Wrong to wrestle with that difference. No, I'm not saying it's wrong to see another boat on the river. But I think that there is a deep longingness in each of us for those expansive spaces and for that solitude. And I think that there's a level of respect for those other boats that some people have and some people don't. I don't mind seeing another boat on the river. I don't mind waving, sharing a smile, a conversation. Some of my best encounters and memories of fly fishing the White River are encounters with complete strangers. But I've also been run over by guys in jet boats, and I've also been waked out, and I've also had guys blaring their music going all the way around the bend to the point that it does ruin my experience. And so I think we just have to figure out how we deal inside all of the noise of that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, the elephant in the room is, unfortunately, and Dustin, this isn't a jab at you. I was a guide for 10 years. But the elephant in the room, if we really want to talk about, we want less people on public ground and we want less people on the rivers we like to fish, remove the safety net. Remove the guide.
Remove the accessibility that a guide would
remove
present.
The guide.
Yeah.
That's where it comes from. It comes from the fact that there are thousands of people who every year make a decision that they're going to make their livelihood being a guide. And because of that...
Oh, absolutely.
And because of that, and I'm not knocking on it, it's just simple facts, right? They create access to people who would never go do it by themselves. They create the opportunity. Now, I, for one, would rather them have the opportunity because I think God is going to meet them and I think their life is going to be changed the more they increase their encounters in nature. So, to me, hey, man, we've gotten to a place in society where most people don't have the skill, the equipment, or the fortitude to go off on their own, right, and say, I'm going to forge ahead and figure this out. And the hope, and Dustin, what I know, not knowing you at all, but what I know from how I've seen Taylor mature as an angler through his friendship with you is you operate like as a guide, like I operated as a guide, which was if you weren't better at the end of my time with you, then I failed. If I wasn't working towards a day where you didn't need me at all anymore and it was your personal decision because you enjoyed my company to continue to hire me, but frankly, you didn't need me, then I wasn't doing my job as a guide. And what we need is more guides like that. And from what I can tell of Taylor's experiences with you, you and your crew are those type of guides. It's not just about the let me take your money and put you on fish. It's let me.
Well, I think that's the biggest problem in guiding right now.
Right. Let's not even get to the saltwater game.
Say that again.
I said let's not even talk about the saltwater game.
I mean, I see it in all aspects. You know, the White's one of those interesting rivers, though.
It is.
You know, in Colorado, I had some clients that literally only got guides to float because they didn't have a boat. You know, they could fish. They could go walk and wade. They had their, you know, $2 million house up on the hill, and they would spend their 2-3 weeks there, and they'd go, you know, wade fish every day and get a boat, you know, once a week. You know, that I agree with. A lot of those people don't need guides, and they don't, or some of them just don't have the fortitude, as you said, to go do it. And I mean, they are so easy to find walking wade access. I mean, look at the South Platte River. I mean, there's an access, you know, everywhere you look. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful public river that you can go find a stretch for yourself or, you know, with fewer people if you just go look. The White, on the other hand,
it's got one way. It's got one way, right? Like, if you really want to fish it, it's got one way to do it.
Well, the problem is the flows. If it's low water, yeah, there's a handful of the lock and wade accesses.
Wouldn't recommend it.
But if that water comes up, you kind of got to be in a boat.
Yeah, 100%. And there's some arguments to be made. I think no different than arguments or things that have happened in some states of really regulating the number of boats that are allowed on a section of a river. Period. You know, like,
yeah.
Hey, you have a permit and your permit allows you X number of guided guide boats that can operate underneath that permit. And
yeah, or your daily limits. I mean,
exactly.
You know, your yearly user day limits.
Yep.
I mean, that's gone a long way to help. You know, the reality of it is, like I said, I would never tell anyone that, you know, I don't want them to fish because the river is busy. I don't, you know, that's the great thing about the White, though, is I don't really like fishing around a ton of people. So, say, like, when the dam opened February 1st, you know, there's 40 guides up there. We had the river to ourselves. We went and caught just as nice as brown trout you know, just not even fishing the dam, and we saw a handful of boats, you know? I mean, we have jet boats, for God's sakes. You can run your boat. And
yeah, go run it.
If you feel like, oh, if you start feeling a little claustrophobic, like everyone's just anchoring or cutting you off or low-holing you, you can turn your motor on and go up or down river and go find yourself, you know, another little area to fish.
And I want to go back to the Colorado thing real quick. Is like, one, obviously Colorado's river systems in general are so impacted by consistency and quality of snow, right? Like, that's
absolutely
one of my issues with ever moving back to Colorado. Like, I don't want to move back anywhere that is so dependent on something you have no control over, in how it impacts your life from water to fire danger to all of it, right? Like,
yeah,
I just don't want to deal with that. But what I will say about Colorado is people want to complain about the major fisheries that are easy to get to, that there's too many people. Then go fish somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Because
I
guess
agree.
What?
When I mean,
it's a good,
what I was just saying,
when it's
know,
a good
you
snow
go to
year.
Flat.
Yeah, when it's a good snow year. Man, some of the greatest days I've ever had in Colorado were on no-name creeks that most people don't know jack diddly about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, or being
well,
an absolute
so much water.
Yeah, so much water, or being an absolute moron and like deciding, you know what, I'm not going to float the Black Canyon. I'm going to go down past Margaritaville and make a river crossing, which for anyone who's floated the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, you'll know where that is. Not a good idea to make a river crossing there. Just going to go ahead and say that. Don't recommend it by anybody, particularly when it's decently high water. You will fill some waders.
Good.
Yeah. But like,
wear your belt.
Didn't see anybody, you know, and caught some monsters that day during the stonefly hatch. Like, my best day on the Mo in Montana, granted, was in February, and 8 inches of snow on the ground. And you know what? No one was fishing that day except me and my idiot friends. And they were still rising to dry flies for 6 straight hours that day, and it was 4 degrees outside.
Wonderful day to
pass. Oh, my God. It was so good. It was so good.
You know, it's funny to me because we were talking about the Dream Stream, right?
Yeah.
If you fish the Dream Stream in the middle of the winter.
Yeah,
there's no one really there.
No.
But, you know, I mean, when I was guiding out there, if I guided a Saturday, well, okay, first of all, everyone's going to try to go enjoy their Saturday. I can't tell them not to. So, you know, like, that's like going skiing on a Saturday or going hunting on a Saturday or, you know, going fishing or going hiking or mountain biking or, you know, whatever activity or hobby you're into. You can bet that, you know, if you do it on a weekend, golf is a prime example. Play golf on a Wednesday versus a Saturday.
And I think that's the point, right? Is like, we need to do a better job of framing our outings, right? Like, if your soul is telling you, man, I need solitude and solo connection with nature. Well, one, don't go on a weekend. And two, don't go to the place that everyone thinks is the coolest place. Like, find your Mecca. Like, go find your spot. It's out there, man. And there really is still so much opportunity in this country to get out and get isolated if you want it. But, yeah, guess what? You're not going to find it on the river that every fishing magazine has talked about for 15 years on a Saturday on the third week of July. Like, jog on. You are not going to find it there, and I really don't want to hear anyone complaining about it anymore.
That's what I was going to say. And also, I mean, when did fly fishing lose its sense of adventure?
A long time ago, sir.
Where everything, you know, I mean, it's sad, though. Like, when I was a kid, I mean, I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was 6, 7 years old riding my bike down to the Arkansas River. I didn't know what I was going to catch.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a striper. It could be a disease. It could be a
bluegill. You don't know.
It could be a largemouth. It could be a gar.
Yeah.
I mean.
We would drive up there from Oklahoma City and do the same thing. Like, we don't know what we're going to find today on the Arkansas. And, you know, that water's not super clean, but we're going to go, you know.
Oh, hell yeah. And there's, you know, there was no stopping us. I mean, we were just kids with fly rods in our hands and poorly tied flies, you know, that.
Getting them from the backwoods up there when the Tulsa backwoods used to be there.
Oh, this is like 1992.
Yeah, that Tulsa backwoods was there in the 90s.
Yeah, but I don't know. Did they have their fly fishing section really there?
Not till later on, but yeah.
Yeah, that was later. But, you know, I mean, we were just kids on bicycles riding around with fly rods.
That's right.
We could figure out.
I love
it. And we were the only ones fly fishing. I mean, for half my life, people told me, oh, well, there's no trout in here. You know, you kind of had to.
We were like, yeah, we weren't going for those, but thanks anyways.
Yeah, we're fishing for. The first carp I ever caught changed my life.
They'll do that.
I mean, you know, I mean, I was, what, I was, I don't know, five or six, and, you know, caught one just dragging a woolly bugger. And then I was like, okay, I want to catch carp, you know, and then by the time I was 13, striper.
Yeah.
Took over. You know, I started being able to cast more, understood streamers, understood thinking lines, understood, you know, started really having a little more processing of here's what's in here, here's how you target a species, and, you know, that took over. When I was in college, I mean, I was driving up the northeastern seaboard chasing striper. You know?
I want to talk about your adventure, and I want to talk about what you've got planned, but I'm not doing my job if I don't let us squeeze in a break. So we're going to do that. When we come back, we'll have a few more minutes with Captain Dustin Doss on the other side. This is the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Now back to the Outdoor Hour with your host Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside the Outdoor Hour. We just got a couple of minutes here. Man, we ran long and I love it. Great conversation with my good friend Captain Dustin Doss from Wandering Fly Outfitters. Be sure you check him out. If you're interested in fishing on the White River in the near future, a little further down the road, the Norfolk, anything in that area, he's your guide to go check out. You'll have a great experience. Or if you're interested in the saltwater game too, I can't recommend anybody more than Dustin and all his buddies, regardless of what you're after. So Florida, yep, he knows the tarpon game. He's got all that figured out. Had a real snooky season last year on the Space Coast. So check out Wandering Fly Outfitters. Hey, got to say thank you to our friends over at J.D. Adams & Company for their continued support of the Outdoor Hour. If you're in Oklahoma, if you're in OKC and you're looking to pick up some new gear for fly fishing, hard goods, soft goods, you need a rod or a reel, you know, they've got the poncho shirts in store there, or, you know, I've been decked out in my Howler Brothers stuff again over the week, being at home. It's a great spot to be, great people, and they've got the goods to help you out. So, Dustin, man, we got about 60 seconds left here. Final thoughts. Thanks for being on the show. Let me do this. Will you come back? Can we do a second episode with you so we can talk more about your adventures and trip to Nepal and all that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, man. Well, we would love to have you back. We'll do that in the next couple of weeks. Joshua Wildman Stratton, Maddie Goldfish, on behalf of my good friend Captain Dustin Doss, check out Wandering Fly Outfitters. They're on Instagram, wandering_fly_outfitters. If you want to connect with him, you should do that. You'll have a great time. I am Taylor Maples. This is the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise. Until next time, go boldly. We'll see you outdoors.